Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. For folks in the audience, I just want to let you know we are going to do this order for the agenda, Senate Bill 119, Senate Bill 707, and then Senate Bill 805, and then we will hold the work session towards the end. With that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 119. Beth, if you can provide an overview.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 119 increases fees for commercial growing, production, harvesting, or distribution of shellfish. It also increases annual shellfish cultivation fees for persons using state lands for cultivation from $4 to $14 per acre. May have a revenue impact statement. We have not received one yet. Same with fiscal. It has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And you should have in your packet a letter from Senator Johnson.
Okay. And so Senator Johnson's not here?
No, she's not in Salem today.
Okay. So we have the Department of Agriculture. I'd like to speak on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Senate Bill 119 was introduced by the department, and its purpose is to raise other funds revenue to help support our shellfish program. The department is responsible for inspecting all aspects of Oregon's commercial shellfish operation. This is a requirement that is mandated by the federal government if commercial shellfish is to be shipped out of state. And we currently operate the program to meet a federal minimum. So we are as lean and mean in this program as you can get. The program currently derives a little bit of fee revenue. The fees were established in 1992, I believe, and have not been raised since that time. The program operates at a deficit and is subsidized by our food safety program. So we receive fee revenue, we receive general fund, and then we also receive some money that is derived from the licensing of recreational shellfish operations from ODF&W. They transfer it over to us, and that portion of the money is used for our bay monitoring. So when we monitor bays, if we do have water quality issues and we close a bay, it's closed for both the commercial side and the recreational side. The governor's balanced budget reduces even further the amount of general fund that is available for this program. And so the issue of other fund revenue becomes more and more critical during this legislative session. We spent quite a bit of time in the interim with the various representatives from the commercial shellfish industry looking at various options for fee revenue, and I need to tell you that we do not have consensus on this fee proposal. And I would say it does need work, and we are more than willing to do that. For our purposes, the best thing that we think can happen is to have this bill go down to Ways and Means, gets married up with our budget. As the budget numbers are determined, and if there's general fund that's put back in the program, that would adjust the amount of money that we would need to raise through fee revenues. And then we can continue working on kind of the mix of what would be the right fee numbers. In particular, the cultivation fee is problematic, and I think you will hear some testimony today from folks that have concerns in particular about that portion of the fee increase mix. I think it is probably fair to say that in working with the industry, they recognize that they need to provide more support for the program, but we just couldn't get to agreement on what the right mix of that support should be. And I think that information is also reflected in the letter that Senator Johnson had submitted to the committee. So with that, I think I'll pause and see if you have any questions.
Okay. Questions for the director? Senator.
Thank you, Director. Your fees haven't raised since 1992. Can you give me a reason why that hasn't happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, basically because we've had general fund support in the program. And what's happened over the course of time is that general fund support has really not increased much. course, the costs of operating a program have increased. We know that we've been operating with some subsidy from our food safety program, but in particular with the governor's balanced budget that removes additional general fund from the program to the tune of about $80,000, I think, net. We're really in a position where if we didn't have fee increases and we didn't have general fund restored to the program, we're either really subsidizing the program quite heavily from our food safety program, or we've got to look at drastic cuts to the program.
Follow-up. Will these fee increases, since they seem to be pretty substantial, will they financially put our producers at a disadvantage to other producers up and down the coast?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, some of you had received some information from us prior to the hearing. There are not a whole lot of states that operate a commercial shellfish program because you need to be located on the coast. And the state that is nearest to us that does operate a program, the state of Washington, is actually where we looked to mirror our fees based on their rates. So the fees that are proposed in this bill bring us very much in line with the fees that are charged in the state of Washington. I think everyone has to be honest to say, you know, anytime you're raising fees on producers, you know, that's an additional business expense for them, and that's not something that anyone looks forward to. But I would reiterate that the industry realizes they need to provide more financial support for the program. We just couldn't come up with a mix that was acceptable to everyone.
Follow up? One more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you missed my question, but I asked, would that put us at an economic disadvantage to the producers? I realize the fee structure is about the same, but marketing-wise, when they sold their oysters or their product throughout this region, would the increase in cost that we are going to charge them, would that put them at an economic disadvantage to the producers in Washington?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't believe so. I know you have a couple people that are signed up to testify that could probably give you some good insight on that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for the department? Okay.
Thank you.
I only have Thomas Benke signed up. Thomas, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Hey, anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 119? Okay. You're it. And you brought us a bivalve.
Oh, go and tell.
I don't know if this is funny or not, but all our oysters are free range.
Okay.
No, the free range jokes are only come from up here.
And if you're going to speak over there, we need a microphone for you. That's the problem, and
I'd prefer if we could just bring that over.
Okay.
Can we do that?
And I need you to state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Benke. I'm an environmental attorney, but I've worked with the Hayes family for many, many years, particularly on pollution issues in the Bay. I'm not a lobbyist. I understand that the committee's looking at passing this bill out for further work and ways and means, but there's some things that I just wanted you to know. This is a lot more complicated than the Department of Agriculture may have presented to the committee. That's Tillamook Bay right there. And in the materials that I hope were distributed to you today, you have a black and white copy of this map right here, which are the plat overlays for the bay. And the things that I just want you to understand about the bay is that it's not all just arable acreage. Some of it's underwater all the time. Some of it's underwater part of the time. The other thing that I want you to understand about Tillamook Bay, and I've tried to make clear in my letters, is that not all of the tideland plats in Oregon are created equal. Tillamook is very special in that the legislature many, many decades ago made those tideland plats, at least the ones that are still held by the Hayeses and now are held by Pacific Seafood, private property. One correction I want to make to the Department of Agriculture's testimony today is that the cultivation fees were raised in 1997, I believe, and that's in my materials. The key thing that I want you to understand about the proposed revisions to the bill is that they're taking two completely separate parts of Oregon law, that has two specifically different purposes, and trying to mishmash them for purposes of raising revenue. And the effect on Hayes'
particularly since they've been struggling for so long with shutdowns and closures in the Bay, is to essentially effect a confiscation of those tide lands that Jesse and June are now owned by virtue of their grandfather's effort to get those plats deeded to the growers back in 1938. The other thing that I'd like you to understand is what the closure history of the bay is. If you look in the top right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of the bay, and you'll see that fully, maybe a third of the bay is absolutely prohibited to oyster culture. And these cultivation fees that are presently being assessed and will be assessed are on land that the Hayses are told they can't harvest oysters from, so you can't plant them. So it's absolutely prohibited by law for us to use that acreage, and yet they're still being taxed. The other thing is, on the parts of the bay where they can still use for harvesting, cultivating oysters, all of that red mishmash down there in the bottom right, that is what the fall of the year looks like in Tillamook Bay. That's 7 years, 3 months, and almost half the time the bay is shut down to harvest. So imagine trying to run a business when the government comes in sporadically and says you're shut down and you're going to be shut down for an indefinite period of time. That's what it looks like in Tillamook Bay. Now, my point is that the taxes, any increase in the cultivation fees, is first, contrary to the way the statute's written, the two separate parts. But more than that, it's way disproportionate to any economic value that is presently taken out of that acreage. You're going from $4 an acre, which is a tremendous burden on the Hayses anyway, to $14 an acre. And just to make it clear, one oyster, if we lease out our land, and we do, we get $30 a bushel. I say we because I'm out there a lot, but I don't have any interest in the bays or the oysters. One oyster ends up getting the Hayses one penny, essentially. That's all. And there's been no economic analysis of the burden that these taxes and fees would be put on the various parts of the industry, as opposed to somebody who's actually planting oysters there, growing them, shucking them, distributing them. That's big business. There's a lot of revenue. I don't know how much you think you would pay for this oyster if it was on your plate at Jake's Seafood, but I'm sure that it's substantially more than a dollar. And so from a value-added perspective, I think that the legislature needs to be looking at taxing the people who are actually producing the oysters, the people who are shucking them, the people who are selling them, the people that are getting the lion's share of the revenue, not on the hereditary tideland owners. I have a lot more that I can say, but I do understand that the Department of Agriculture has ceded that there needs to be a lot of work done on this bill, and I'm satisfied that I at least have a voice. So thank you. Do you have any questions?
I'll see if there are any questions for... Gentlemen.
I'll yield to the vice chair and come back afterwards.
Okay.
I'd like to point out to start with, and I know the crowd can't see this map here, but there are several areas on here that have my name on it, Olson, and they're not my oyster beds.
Oh,
so.
Sure.
I thought you were going to declare a potential conflict
for a minute.
Those Olson beds were eventually sold to Pacific Seafood, and so it's Pacific Seafood, Frank Dulcich's outfit, that controls a great deal of the bay, but nearly not as much as the Hayses. And we have a difficult relationship with Pacific, but it's also a working one, and they're beginning to lease some of our beds. And that's where I get 30 cents a bushel, because that's what they pay us.
Well, I do have a question for you. I was told in a meeting that I had that your folks owned or leased most of the bay, and the reason this area wasn't fished is because it wasn't suitable to raise oysters in, but yet they still held on to it to reduce competition in the area. Is there any validity to that statement?
There's no validity to that statement. The beds were actually much more highly utilized at the end of Sam Hayes' life. He died in the early 1990s. But you've got to remember that with the FDA coming in 1976 and starting to shut down the bay and prohibiting when the product can be sold, it was devastating to the owners and operators out there. Eventually, Olson and Harris sold out to Pacific, and Pacific built a new shucking plant out there. The Hayses have held on to the land because they're hoping that they can eventually get the ear of, among others, this committee and improve water quality in the bay. Remember, you know, the bay is shut down, as I've shown, 45% of the time in the winter because of pollution. Most of that's dairy waste pollution. It's not about trying to push competition out. It's about trying to hold on to a heritage so that Jesse and Juna can eventually at least get some money from those lands, either through leasing them or reselling them. They're only valued at $200 an acre. We had a major competitor come in and make a bona fide offer. You've got the material in the submission. So, no, this idea that if Hayses lost hold of their acreage that the state could go in and release and then put the bay back into production is really a false one, because the economics of the bay don't really support that type of production right now. If the water quality were improved and the closures were reduced, then the Hayses could either sell or lease or cultivate the land profitably, and you'd have a vibrant oyster culture in this state. You know, but you just can't do it with the polluting impacts, at least in Tillamook. Not yet.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your input. Certainly appreciate it. We have the material. We'll take a look at it. And thank you for being here today.
Thanks.
Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119. We are going to quickly open up Senate Bill 805 because Senator Peter Courtney would like to introduce the bill, but we're going to then recess that hearing and move on to 707 because we only have a few folks that would like to testify on that, so they can then get back to their business, and then we'll reopen 805. So as soon as I get my committee staff back, I will reopen the hearing. Okay. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 805. Beth, why don't you go ahead and give us the introduction while Senator Courtney comes in.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 805 creates the offense of unlawfully confining an egg-laying hen if the farm owner or operator for a majority of any 24-hour period confines a hen in an enclosure that prevents the hen from lying down, standing up, doing a number of other things that are specified in the bill. It creates some exemptions. There's no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact. We have not yet received a statement, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Courtney, thank you. We've opened up the hearing. We'll take a quick recess after you're done and then reopen it after we finish the other hearing. But thank you for being here to introduce the bill. And can you please state your name for the record?
I'm going to do that. Would you let me get my pages separated, please? I'm Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive, Northeast in Salem, 97303. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodbury. It's a high honor and privilege to be before you, Senator Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, Senator Haas, Senator Brzezinski, Senator Thompson, and you, Committee Administrator Beth Petrino. I've come here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments. Chair Denfield. Now, I'm a softie, and I admit it, when it comes to animal welfare, because animals take care of us 24-7 in every way imaginable. We all know that. Not just companionship and service-wise, but they feed us, they nurture us, and they love us unconditionally. And as I said, animals have treated me a whole lot better than humans. So I have a big place in my heart for animals and the welfare of animals. That brings me to battery cages. Battery cages. The overwhelming majority of the millions of egg Egg-laying hens in Oregon are housed in battery cages. These cages allow each bird just 67 square inches of space. This is less than a sheet of paper for each bird to live their entire lives. Brings us to the new cage. Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 6 amendments would ensure that no new battery cages is ever installed in Oregon. There will be no battery cages installed in Oregon with the Dash 6 amendments. The day is over for the battery cage. This bill with the Dash 6 amendments would mandate that any new cage installation would give hens 87% more space and would be enriched with perches and scratching pads. Hens in Oregon would finally be able to move around, perch, and flap their wings. Department of Agriculture. Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 6 amendments would direct Oregon egg producers to file a plan with the Oregon Department of Agriculture outlining how they will perform cage conversions. The bill would also direct the Department of Agriculture to inspect egg producers to ensure the conversion is taking place. A progress report would be given by the Department of Agriculture to the Legislative Assembly each year. Liquid eggs. Liquid eggs, something I knew nothing about until I took this on. We have written the Dash 6 Amendment so that no form of egg production is exempted. This is going to become a critical part of the discussion. No form of egg production is exempted. They're all covered by the Dash 6 Amendments. Today, about one-third of all egg production is focused on producing eggs which are not the usual shell eggs we buy in the cartons. It is my belief that we should be finding ways to improve the welfare of all hens, regardless of what type of egg they are raised to produce. Enriched colony cages. Enriched colony cages. That is how the cages will become under the Dash 6 Amendments. That is what they have called the enriched colony cage. On January 1, 2006, all egg-laying hens in Oregon will be housed in enriched colony cage systems and will be afforded 116.3 square inches of space per bird. You recall the space they now have as compared to the 67 square inches. While this timeline is longer than I initially envisioned, it is much longer. It will allow the industry, to make the necessary changes over that period of time. I've worked with my staff, and I brought him up here. Ryan Mann has done extraordinary work in this area. Probably more work, has more knowledge than anyone I've ever known because of what he's done in such a short period of time. He's also a graduate of Great Oregon State University. Duck. I have worked with my staff as representative, and I work with representatives from the Oregon Humane Society. And the Oregon producers, to craft these ideas and find some common ground. The Oregon Humane Society and the egg producers here in our great state. Thus far, and this is sadness I have it outlined in bold black print. Fully to admit to you, Senator Dingfelder, and great members of this committee, thus far I have been unable to strike magic. I am very sad. I have not been able to bring the perfect bill. While our work group has made progress, you will hear divergent testimonies today. Some feel the Dash 6 amendments would not sufficiently improve hen welfare. I'll let them speak for themselves. I assume they're in the room. Some feel the bill and the Dash 6 amendments go too far in regulating the industry. There are major international corporations that oppose the work we have done. There are major national advocacy groups that oppose the work we have done. They are here. There is science that supports each group's position, and we have talked with respected experts that agree with our approach and with others that do not. Ryan Mann and myself have gone on the phone to not only different parts of this country, but he even as far away as Europe to get knowledge on this subject. The experts we have consulted include professors of animal science in this state, from across the country, and even around the globe. My staff also spoke with renowned animal welfare expert Temple Grandin, who was the subject of a major motion picture. Everyone has their biases and has different solutions to the problem, but I believe that we are moving in the right direction. I can truly say that everyone involved, everyone, all those I've indicated, all the organizations involved, does care about hen welfare. That is what makes me so sad about this. Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 6 amendments may not be perfect. I believe that it would facilitate changes to the egg production industry that would make marked improvements to the welfare of the hen. This bill's provision would allow for continued high-volume production of eggs and has a timeline that would allow the egg producers to navigate the marketplace as they make changes. There are other processes to address our society's problems. Sometimes we go to the courts to solve the problems. Sometimes we make laws through the initiative process. Making public policy that way often results in simplistic solutions to larger problems. It is my hope that we can utilize the people's branch, the legislature, to find a solution to what is a complex issue. Again, Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, my fellow senators, I thank you very much for even allowing me to come here and to speak on this piece of legislation.
Are you done?
I am done. That is my final moment.
Thank you, Senator. We know that you have to be somewhere else about this
time. I'm fine.
Time.
I have whatever you want to do with me.
Would you like to stay for a couple of questions in case there are any?
You mean right now?
Right now.
I'll take whatever you have to give me. Comments,
questions,
or criticism.
Mr. President, thank you very much. And it was quite an honor that you appointed me as vice chair of this committee, because it's my responsibility to be at the beck and call of the chair, and the chair would like to know what came first, the egg or the chicken.
Oh, that's my question.
With all seriousness,
Mr. President, thank you very much for your testimony. I do have but one question that I always look at from an Oregonian standpoint. Will this put us at an economic disadvantage to other egg producers in different states?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, that was discussed over and over again in our work group, and the egg producers' representatives are here to talk about that. That is why we designed this, to make sure that the egg producers in Oregon can handle the market situation and also transition into these new cages, because they want these new cages. I believe that we're this close to being able to say yes, this close. And that is what really pains me more than anything else. Now, there is a major national corporation I won't name that is totally opposed to what we're doing because of liquid eggs. And there is the major advocacy group that is totally opposed because this thing just doesn't go far enough. But specifically, we focused on the egg producers in Oregon and the Northwest and tried to draw the Dash 6 amendments in a way that would allow them to transition from the battery cage into the enhanced colony cage, and still be able to be viable in the market. So that's as close as I can get. There is one little sticking point. I believe I'm going to call it little, but I believe the answer, if we can resolve that sticking point, would be yes to your question, if we could resolve that.
One follow-up. One more follow-up. Since I've seen these cages that you're talking about, and they are larger, would you stand behind an effort if these producers had to increase their building sizes in the EFU markets that they're in? Would you stand behind an issue to help them put larger buildings on the land that they currently own?
Chair Jenkins, or Senator Olson, that's a very interesting question. I don't know what you're talking about. Are we talking about now major land use changes, exclusive farming? I'm not trying to play games with you.
No.
But your question is a bit confusing.
Let me try to clarify. The cages that you're asking for are larger than the cages
that currently use. It's 116.3 versus 67. Right.
So they're not going to get as many cages per building, which means that they're either going to have to make the buildings larger or make more buildings to have the same number of chickens. So my question is, would you help us to modify land use so that they could make more buildings in the areas that they own, if they're not allowed at this time?
That's a question we didn't discuss that, because if I may, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we understand one of the major producers, big time producers, is ready to move and plans new buildings, and that was brought up in our work group. Now, I don't want to speak for him, and that never came up, that they would need help. So I don't know how to even begin to respond to your question.
Okay.
But in fact, I'm being very frank with you.
Well,
that did not come up.
When they come up.
That's fine.
So I'm not trying to say, I just don't know what to do with that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? I think Senator Przanski is on the verge.
I'll take whatever you want.
I know that you had to be somewhere else.
No, we've changed it all.
If I could, Mr. President, what would be, I think, a good graphic for us, if we could actually get one of the cages in here so we can actually see what it looks like and what the alternative is, to give a perspective. I understand from your testimony taking a sheet of paper, but I think having that visual would be worth maybe 1,000 words or so.
Chair Degenfelder, Senator Przanski, the battery cage actually has been in Ryan's office for a while. It may have been retrieved by now. Is it still there?
I think it's still there.
So we may be able to, since we're going to recess, we may be able to bring it down.
Right, the battery cage. Now, the enhanced colony, we don't have that cage, or the what you call cage-free, which you're going to hear about, and that cage. I have seen drawings on my chalkboard as to how they would look. So that's the best I can do. The only thing we do have, Chair Dingfeller, is we do have in our office the battery cage, which is the one that we are trying to transition from. That's the best I can do, Senator.
Since we're in a recess, maybe we can have Brian bring it down. I think that would be helpful. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. President. I think we will... we're going to recess, take one other hearing, and then come back to that. In the meantime, we can incubate on this issue for a while. And
that was
I had to get that one in. Ryan, I'm assuming you will be back with the cage, and then if there are other questions for the Senate President's office. Thank you. With that, we will recess Senate Bill 805, and we will open up a hearing on Senate Bill 707. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview, and then I think Senator Przanski wanted to say a few words on this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 707 requires a seller of property with a septic system to obtain an inspection report before selling the property and to provide the report to each buyer who makes a written offer to purchase the property and to the Department of Environmental Quality. It authorizes the buyer to withdraw the offer to purchase within 3 days of receiving the report. There's no revenue impact, we've not received a fiscal impact, and there's no subsequent referral.
Okay. Senator Przanski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason for Senate Bill 707 is, as the committee administrator set forth, is to trying to give information to a buyer at the time of a real estate transaction, whether or not if the property has a septic system, whether it is functioning and maintaining and properly in use. As this committee knows, we've already heard of impacts on various waterways, many of those waterways that are actually the water source for communities that are being impacted by having a failure in these septic systems. And this would be a way to ensure to the buyer that whether it is up to grade and can handle their needs and the load of the septic system, that, and also making certain that we're not seeing negative impact into our waterways that are the water sources for many communities.
Okay, thank you. I am going to ask Jason Huser, right? Is that saying that right, Jason? And Carl Morgenstern from, you're both from eWeb, right, to come up. Okay, welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Jason Huser with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'd like to share with you eWeb's strong support for Senate Bill 707, which, as you've heard, will require a septic inspection as part of the property transfer process. We think this bill will promote water quality as well as serve as a valuable consumer protection tool for many prospective home buyers. eWeb is a drinking water provider that serves over 200,000 citizens from a single source of drinking water, the very beautiful McKenzie River. As a result of having one sole source, eWeb is very committed to activities that promote and maintain the great water quality we have in that watershed. An emerging risk to water quality that eWeb has identified is the failure of septic systems. Mr. Morgenstern is going to elaborate more on that. So I'm going to skip ahead to a little bit about what the bill does and why we think this is really the most appropriate and opportune point to try to address bringing failing systems into compliance. In 2009 and into early 2010, DEQ had an on-site advisory board that met for, I believe, 7 to 8 months and considered many different strategies on how to bring failing systems into compliance. I think at the end of the day, from EWEB's point of view, time and again, there was one scenario that kept coming up as the best incremental, manageable, and opportune point in time, and that was at time of transfer. And requiring an inspection at time of transfer does four things from our point of view. One, ensure a system is functioning properly without risk to nearby ground or surface water. Number two, protect home buyers from being stuck with extremely expensive repair or replacement costs. Three, including septic systems among critical features of a home in need of possible repair that are negotiated between a buyer and a seller, like the many warts that older homes occasionally have. And I know I own an older home myself. These negotiations can, in many cases, hopefully produce a repair to a system. And finally, number four, and I think this is really important, the inspection process will educate homeowners on the importance of properly maintaining and servicing their septic systems over time. I think I want to also draw your attention to a Dash 1 amendment that I hope has been passed out. Mm-hmm. That Dash 1 amendment would eliminate the sharing of the inspection reports to DEQ. I think at one time there was a thought that sharing information with DEQ would be great, that data collection. I think since then we've decided that it would be better to make this a more simple and straightforward part of the property transfer process. So that's the idea behind the Dash 1 amendments. I also would like to make reference to a prospective amendment that I believe Legislative Council is working on as we speak. Some folks, and I think you'll hear more testimony from them on this subject, have identified that it's going to be very important to clarify the qualifications of the folks that are going to be doing the inspections, and secondly, clarifying the scope of what's going to be inspected. There will be amendments forthcoming that will mirror elements in administrative rules for DEQ that pertain to an existing time of transfer requirement for what's known as an ATT system. So I guess I think of it as the Cadillac of septic systems. There is something in OAR already there, and these amendments would mirror the criteria for qualifications and the scope of inspections. And at some point in the future, you'll be seeing those amendments. I hope that'll address those issues. Additionally, these prospective amendments would include what's known as a look back. If there's been an inspection in the last 2 years, it wouldn't make sense to require another one. That's basically the elements that those amendments will try to address. And I'm going to let Mr. Morgenstern talk a little bit more about the need for this bill, and after he's done, perhaps we can both try to tackle any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here to talk to you about the importance of this the bill to protect, at least from our perspective, municipal water systems. My job at EWEB is to protect the McKenzie as Eugene's sole source of drinking water.
Can you say something?
And above our intake, there's about 4,000 septic systems. And
we just need you to state your name again, and you can actually sit back from the microphone. It's actually very sensitive,
okay,
so you don't have to
hear myself.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah,
I
we can
shout.
Hear you fine.
Hear
so you just state your name again for
okay.
the record, please.
Is that better? Carl yeah. Morgenstern with Eugene Water Electric Board.
Great, thank you.
And so above our intake, there's about 4,000 septic systems that exist, and discharging about on average 900,000 gallons of household wastewater a day. And basically, when a system is properly designed, sited, and maintained, they're a very effective way to treat household waste. However, when a septic system malfunctions or they fail, they can discharge untreated household wastewater into groundwater and nearby surface water containing high levels of bacteria, nitrates, other contamination, or pollution. The causes of system failures, as you may know, are numerous. Could be inadequate soils, poor design, tree roots in the drain fields, hydraulic overloading, old age, use of household toxins, or garbage disposals, or the failure to conduct regular maintenance and cleanouts. And according to the Groundwater Foundation, who's done a lot of research on this, improper and infrequent maintenance is really the common cause of a lot of system failures. So what EWEB did to evaluate this threat and Eugene's sole source of drinking water is we received some funding and added our own funding. We received some grants from Oregon DEQ and DHS to launch a septic system assistance program for homeowners in our watershed. And this program essentially looked at not only mapping septic systems, but providing homeowners in high-priority areas free inspections and pump-outs, well sampling of homeowners, and then education. And so these high-priority areas I mentioned include about 1,100 of the 4,000 systems. And these are homes that are in what we're calling denser areas, high clusters of septics that are in gravelly or permeable soils next to the river or other water bodies. So from this program, we inspected 439 of these systems. And 108 of those required a pump out, which means that the system was not functioning properly. The scum or sludge layers built up, reducing treatment that occurs in these septic systems. And 55 systems were seen to be failing or need major repairs. The majority of these systems that were failing were due to damaged or improperly functioning drain fields and or deteriorated or collapsed septic tanks. So that's a 12.5% failure rate. So if you might multiply that times 4,000 systems, that's you're looking at about what is the math on that? 4,800 or 480 systems. The EPA looks at about 10 to 20% failure rate across the nation. So this fits within that. To date, these 55 failing systems, three of them have been repaired based on county permits. The average age of the systems we looked at were 24.3 years old. And it also should be noted that homeowners that we worked with, a number of them, in fact, many of them, did not know where their septic system was or their drain field, and which led to the building of decks, patios, landscaping, and other features over their septic tank, basically preventing access. So basically, the other thing I want to point out during this two-year effort is that the water quality sampling that we did upstream and downstream of these cluster areas and shallow groundwater indicated in a number of these areas increased trends in nitrates and bacteria as you move from upstream to downstream or from upgrading to downgrading in shallow groundwater. So Senate Bill 707 would provide a way to incrementally and gradually allow repair and replacement of failing systems as properties are sold across the state. And these inspections, the requirement of these inspections at time of sale will lead, obviously, to many systems to be repaired over time. And as Jason mentioned, Senate Bill 707 would provide a number of benefits to Oregonians, some of which he mentioned, such as protecting water quality by ensuring properly functioning systems, protect home buyers, allows septic repairs and replacement and negotiated sale during the negotiated sale and financing a home purchase rather than later when there's less funding available to do this. And one of the things that Jason did mention about the education, also this will allow septic systems and their components to be properly mapped at the time of the sale so that homeowners do know where these systems exist on their property. I think the last thing that this bill would do is increase economic activity and potential job creation in the on-site wastewater industry associated with inspections, maintenance, servicing, repairs, and replacement of septic systems. So I appreciate the time to share our thoughts with you, and thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you. Questions?
Of course. Mm-hmm. Mr. Morgenstern, you say that it would allow these systems to be properly mapped. It's my understanding when a county approves a septic system, they're laid out, they're mapped, they're thoroughly documented. I know this to be a fact. Do you know this to be a fact also?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, when we were looking at at this threat to our drinking water, we went to county records and basically with that assumption. And in fact, when we inspected each of these 439 systems, we went to county records to pull the file and look at where the system was so we could give it to our contractor. I would say, and I don't have the stats off the top of my head, but 30 to 40% of those systems that were inspected did not have documentation as to where that system was actually located on that property.
Could you tell me how old these houses were that you're inspecting?
Well, like I said, the average age was 24.3 years old of the 439 systems. So there's a range there, obviously, but some of them are very old, yes.
Follow up? When a home is usually typically sold, typically don't homeowners ask for a sewer inspection?
I guess, Jason, you're a...
The answer is yes. I don't think we've uncovered a statistic that would show what percentage of transfers voluntarily as an agreement between the buyer and seller have an inspection. But certainly we know that that does happen. I know my mother-in-law just sold her home in, outside Baker City, and there was an inspection there. So it certainly is frequently done. We don't have a stat, though.
That being the case, then why do we need a law to make it mandatory?
Well, I think we would really prefer 100% of the time a septic inspection was done.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
Follow-up.
Senator Prezanski.
I assume from what your testimony is and being part of the district I represent, the McKenzie River, since that is the primary water source, wouldn't it be important for the citizens that rely on that water to have the information whether a system is actually operating and not failing and actually causing system to have unintended consequences on the water source that is providing the water to the city, of, in this case, Eugene?
Madam Chair and Senator Prezanski, if I understand your question, it'd be, shouldn't we be capturing the information from these inspections so that we know that they are happening? Is that the...
Yes,
I would, you know, ideally we would like to see that, but the reality is that this, you know, to move some, this concept forward, we're looking at basically treating it as a home inspection, essentially, where it's between the buyer and the seller, and you assume that from that realization that a system is failing with the lender at the table and seeing that, that there would be a proper attention provided to repair or replace that system. Ideally, yes, we would like to see the inspection reports captured in a way that we could actually look at them and assess that information.
Let me, if I can, kind of rephrase this. Besides being important between the buyer and seller, there's also a third-party beneficiary, being the individuals that are relying on that water source that could be contaminated from a failed system. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next up, Kim Aldrich and Dan Buss and Brian Raby, right? Thank you. Thank you. And you've handed out you're handing out your written testimony. I'm going to ask you if you cannot read this, but please just summarize key points.
Yes, too much. It's more for reference material.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
I'm Kim Aldridge, president of Oregon Wastewater Association, as well as county regulator for Yamhill County. Senator Dingfelder, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, members of the committee, we're just here. We looked over the bill. We, O2WA as an organization, has looked over the bill. We want to take the opportunity to comment on it. We generally support the concept and the theory of the bill. However, we... are concerned with some of the ways how it's written. With the new amendment that's been added, DEQ is taken out of the loop. We are concerned about that, basically based on who would regulate, who would be able to perform these inspections, as well as the criteria from, you know, what are we going to be looking at. A septic inspection is only as good as who is performing the inspection. And personally, I know of in my county, I have a couple of gentlemen that perform some inspections where they pump the tank, stick a hose down the tank, tanks tank it on water, it's good. However, they don't look at the drain field. So we definitely need to establish criteria so we can make this a good bill. I would also like to take the opportunity to address a question that Senator Olson said about percentages of who, how many of these actually, these systems are done, where they take the inspections and they're already done. I have done some, but this is a recent trend where the bank organizations, they're the ones that are requiring the inspections. Previously, in any homes that greater than 30 years old, that's where we're seeing the problems, and a lot of these homes are just recently selling, so we're having a chance to address these, but previously these hasn't been done, and we'd like to see this started on all homes. Okay. Also, I have a few case studies in the back, and I will just summarize this quickly. But
actually, we're really short on time, so
okay.
we can read these
you
on our own.
You can read this, and know that these are some of the people that were directly affected by not having these inspections done. And in the back, I've created, added the information from the DEQ. This is our 131, 340, 71, 131. These are the rules that govern time of transfer inspections through the DEQ, and this would be a good place to start. These are things that we could look at to bring in. Instead of recreating the wheel, this would be a good place to start. So is there any questions? And then I'll pass it on to my cohorts here.
Why don't we hear from them first
okay.
and see if there's any questions. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senate Committee, my name is Dan Buss. I am an installer here in the Salem area. I've lived in Oregon for 54 years. Currently do all things in the form of septic installation as far as maintenance and service, and done some design work also. Spent the last 6 years on the O2WA board. But I'm not representing them here today. One of the things that I look at as far as these inspections go is, you know, currently we have different inspections set up for the purpose of protecting the homeowner and the lending agent. Currently we don't have anything for the septic system. But the septic system not only protects them, but it protects their neighbors. It protects our streams and waterways. So I think it's real important that we start, you know, addressing this issue. Our concern, once again, is I certainly support point-of-sale inspections. I think it's something that's needed. I think that as one of the instructors for both the on-site certification program and the O&M certification program, I think that we need some kind of point at which, you know, this is regulated. Just by enacting that we need to have this inspection doesn't tell us anything. These inspectors need to be trained. We need to have a protocol set up for the way these things are done. Without consistency, we will find that all it does is go from one inspector to the next inspector until they get the answer that they want. And so without having some way of recording this, that inspection has been done, then that's exactly what happens. It goes to the next inspector until they find the right answer. You know, eventually they'll start figuring out ways to hide these things. So I think it's very important that we set up the correct procedure, get a certification program in place, and set up a protocol for the way these inspections need to be done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess this will carry well enough.
Yep.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Brian Raby, and I'm a certified professional soil scientist, a wastewater sanitary specialist, new term. And I've been designing systems for nearly 25 years in Oregon, and just finished 4 years as a board member and officer with the Oregon On-Site Wastewater Association, two of those years as president. And this is a matter that's fairly near and dear to my heart. I was on a committee in the mid-1990s, and I brought this issue up to that committee. It kind of fell flat at that point in time. Lenders requiring this inspection was fairly limited. And has been fairly sporadic. I think it became even less prevalent during what you might call the building boom years. But when foreclosures started to increase and defaults started to increase, lenders started getting smart and deciding that they better require this to reduce their risk. So it has become, I think, more prevalent, but I still don't think it's universal. I, too, have, you know, numerous examples I could share, both in the commercial real estate realm as well as residential stories I've heard, where there have been some significant financial hardship on people who, you know, struggled to make that purchase and then only to discover after the fact that they had significant problems that they had to wrestle with. I think there's probably a number of those that the banks ultimately had to wrestle with. So, you know, having this brought forth as a disclosure item at the time of transaction offers all parties an opportunity to be able to understand what they have and deal with it in an open fashion. If I may address for just a moment Vice Chair Olson's question about the records. Prior to about 1976, the records are almost non-existent for those older systems. So the program became official, as you might say, about, I don't remember the exact date, but it was around 1976. So there should be pretty good records for most systems since then. But I can also attest that, you know, from county to county and person to person within those counties, and through time, you know, there's a tremendous variation in the quality of those records, going from barely the back of a napkin sketch to very detailed with distances and compass readings in some instances, very detailed documentation of where the systems are. And, you know, to reinforce one of the points that the gentleman from eWeb made, it does provide an opportunity to educate that new homeowner that, in fact, they do have a septic system. I've been through this process myself. The house I live in, I bought almost 11 years ago. And, I'm an informed buyer because of the fact that I do this for a living. I know what to ask about. I know what to look for. On the other hand, when it comes to, you know, the condition of the roof, I haven't a clue, and I rely on experts to tell me that. But the risks associated with a malfunctioning septic system, the cost of repairing that, can greatly exceed the cost of even a bad roof or some of the other problems that are currently looked at and are a potential risk to buyers. So the other key thing I wanted to reinforce has to do with the qualifications, and that's what most of my letter deals with, actually, is the qualifications part. There's some housekeeping items in there with some of the statutory references in the bill that need to be updated because they reference septage rather than septic systems, and so I've proposed that with the other statutory references in the letter I wrote. But the qualifications and the procedures or protocol that are used need to be very specific so that from place to place and person to person and through time, these inspections are relatively consistent. Consistency is important not only for fairness between buyers and sellers, but also again throughout our state in terms of people being treated equitably in that regard. So with that, I'll
thank you. Are there any questions?
No.
Our next people would be Peggy Lynch.
Thank you.
Sean Jillians.
The Kumbaya panel.
Who'd like to go first?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League adopted positions on water quality in January of 1969. For the past 3 years, the League has again studied water quality, and many of you have seen our water quality books, and I have given you the URL so that you can find that information on the web. But I wanted to emphasize our 1969 position states that League members are concerned about ground and surface water pollution and are anxious to see the problems caused by malfunctioning septic tanks eliminated. League favors strict state laws regulating the placement and maintenance of septic tanks. It's nice to be here today to support Senate Bill 707. Our March 2010 publication shares the story of Lapine, and that's on page 14 of our part two of our water study, again, that you can get on the URL. And if you have not heard of the story, I think you have heard some of the story of Lapine in a different bill that you had hearings on recently, where high levels of nitrates have been found. Quote, the results of the study show that in many of the existing individual septic systems contribute to the nitrate problem. We're in the midst of studying coastal issues, and preliminary research findings indicate that over 30% of residents and businesses in Oregon, over 30%, have septic systems. And the EPA estimates, as you heard, that 10 to 20% of all septic systems fail each year. Concerns about seepage and groundwater contamination have been raised in our coastal areas. Locations such as Silcoos Lake and Dune City, as well as other coastal lake properties of concern. And on a personal note, I can share for Lane County residents, they might know of Triangle Lake, a very pretty little, small little place to fish for some bluegill or to do a little recreation with your motorboat. If you drive down Highway 36, you will see that there are porta-johns along all of those houses because, in fact, they cannot use their septic systems on Triangle Lake because of the pollution that has occurred. For Senator Haas, the septics in Garden Home, there are still some still there, even though Garden Home is right near the large city of Portland and next to and in some cases in the city of Beaverton, and there are now sewer systems available to those people, but in fact I believe they can still use their septics until they choose to link up or until they're forced to. So this is not just one small local issue, and certainly you heard from eWeb. So Senate Bill 707 protects our drinking water. It will help assure that our children are not playing on soil that is contaminated by raw sewage. Many home buyers in areas where homes are on septic are not aware of what to ask related to the quality of a septic system and have no knowledge about how to care for one. So this is a public health issue. And I want to address a couple of the comments I've heard already. I really support, and we really support, DEQ getting the information. We worked on a bill last session with the Department of Public Health Drinking Water Division related to making sure that they had the information about contaminants in the water related to wells. I believe that in this case, it's an issue that would help our DEQ know where there are issues, because oftentimes it is not just one system that has failed, but as in the Lapine area, it's because of the underlying soils issue. So it becomes a broader issue for them to be able to look at. I like the idea of a two-year look back. One would presume that a septic system, if it's been looked at in the last 2 years, is probably not effective, you don't need another inspection. And as far as I know, although it's refreshing to hear that mortgage lenders are now asking for this information, the truth is with a home purchase, very often it's with a septic system, you take out what you put in, and that's pretty much the requirement from realtors.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Peggy. Thank you very much. Sean?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, unfortunately in opposition to Senate Bill 707. We certainly support informed consumers, and I'd just like to point out a few things in our current law that are there that seem to have gotten a little bit pushed aside. That's ORS 105-464, the mandatory seller's disclosure. If you all look at page 6 of your bill, actually, if you have the bill in front of you, you can see the section that relates to sewage systems. There are 5 questions there, multi-part questions about septic systems. Some of them are, is the property connected to an on-site septic system? If yes, was it installed by permit? Has the system been repaired or altered? Has the condition of the system been evaluated and a report issued? Has it ever been pumped? If so, when? Are there any sewage system problems or needed repairs? When a seller of a property sells their home, they're required to fill out this report and put that in there. And failure to do that is cause for action if they fail to put things that they knowingly knew. So this is required. We already have a system in place that requires that. But we go a step further in the real estate industry, and we have what's called the Oregon Property Buyer Advisory. It's actually published. It used to be published in conjunction with the Oregon Association of Realtors and the Oregon Real Estate Agency. Now we publish it, and the real estate agency makes it available. So all of our members have it. It's on our site. It's on the consumer side of the Oregon Real Estate Agency. It has a section on sewer and septic systems, and I'm just going to read 2 lines. I won't take up a bunch of your time, Madam Chair. It says, if the property has a septic system or other on-site wastewater treatment system, the system should be inspected by a licensed septic system installer or other on-site wastewater treatment system professional hired by the buyer. Information about on-site wastewater treatment systems and licensed installers and pumpers can be found on the website for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. It has a clickable link right there. It's a live document on both of our websites, and people can find out about that. So, you know, I think you've heard that lenders are requiring it more and more. Our members are all encouraging folks who buy a rural property to have the septic inspection done. We certainly support the concept. The question is, should the government be mandating that it has to happen? And we would argue that it shouldn't. It should be something that the buyer and seller negotiate, as long as people are informed, and these statutory documents require that they actually be informed on it. It was interesting hearing about Triangle Lake or the McKenzie, because I did grow up in Eugene and I spent several summers guiding on the McKenzie. I certainly love it as much as anyone in this room. The question, though, is whether or not the real estate industry can handle another mandate being placed that requires any more on a seller of a property right now. I pulled our most recent numbers just so I could give them to you all, and 39% of all sales now are what we deem distressed properties. 39% of the sales. That means they're either foreclosures or they're short sales, where the person is selling the property for less than they owe on it. In addition, that does not take into account those folks who are underwater, who are able to bring money to the table to get out of their property. And so when you talk about adding additional dollars to a seller in this current market, it's a very real problem. Even if it's only $150 or $200 for an inspection, it's a very real problem when people are bringing money to the table to be able to sell. This isn't the boom years where people were raking in money and profits when they're selling their homes. The other thing that I would caution you on is point-of-sale mandates are very inefficient. The average property turns over a little over every 7 years. On rural properties, it's much lower than that. It's closer to every 10 years. And so if you're really trying to get at the problem of existing septic systems that are failing, consumer education to existing home buyers now, encouraging them to get their septic inspection done while they own the home to make sure it's not failing, is far more efficient use of resources to make sure that the problems are being addressed. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Yeah, Sean, so are you saying that we should mandate that these tests should be done now on existing properties, on existing owners?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, that's certainly not the position of the Oregon Association of Realtors. We do have members, though, who have come from other states where they have a rolling 5-year inspection requirement. I could tell you that if that were the bill were proposed, I think Mr. Honeycutt would be in here with his group, probably more so than we would, and there'd be some significant concern. I'm sure Vice Chair Olson wouldn't be particularly thrilled with that either in the discussions I've had with him. But, you know, I think when you're looking at, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mandate there, Senator. I think if you're looking at educating them beyond just what's required here, if there were education materials that our members could give out to folks in the EWEB region, perhaps, and say, okay, you've purchased a rural property. Here's how you handle a septic tank. You don't have a garbage disposal. You don't put things down there to clog them up. Informing people on the front end is far better than requiring an inspection on the back end.
All right, a couple other questions if I can. Not sure the last time you floated the McKenzie, but I assume in your days that you were guiding and the rafts and stuff, you see the coming out of the natural area into the more populated areas where there is clearly leakage of the septic systems?
Senator, I was actually up there 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And so I was talking to other folks about this bill. As someone, and I probably shouldn't say this on the record, but someone who's a resident of Sherwood, I would drink the water straight from the McKenzie before I would drink our current drinking supply, which comes from the Willamette at Wilsonville.
I understand. Definitely downriver.
Yes. Yeah. I never noticed a true distinction of the water clarity going down. Now, of course, we're running from Olali down to, say, Helfrich. We're not running the true lower section of the river. But I can tell you, up at that point in the river, you do not see points where you'd see a bloom coming out of.
We'll have to go on the river together. I'll show you a couple of places. Last question. Do you not believe that there is a third-party beneficiary obligation here, not just between the buyer and seller, but in the case of those who actually are relying on that particular river or any other river for their drinking water source, to make certain contamination isn't going in there that could be stopped?
It's a trick law school question.
I know, yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Pozanski, I love, you know, when lawyers start playing lawyer here at the table. I'm not sure that this bill is the best way to address that situation.
Could you give us your suggestions of how the best way to address it so we can make certain that those waterways are, in fact, going to not have contamination, that you and I don't have to worry about drinking? Thank you.
I think that might be a follow-up question.
Yeah.
For a follow-up discussion.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, perhaps we'll have to hit the river one of these days and we can discuss it that point.
Good question.
I was going to say the same thing, Madam Chair, that this cries out for a field hearing in the form of a raft trip.
Okay.
We can do it.
Yeah. I still know plenty of guides, Senator Haas, and they'd be happy to take us out there.
Any other questions for either of these panelists? Okay.
So, Madam Chair, I just... So
quick,
Benton County
quick
has
follow-up. We are pressed for time.
Okay.
Yep. Go ahead.
Benton County has a wonderful rural, how to be a rural landowner booklet that I'd be happy to make sure that the realtors, if they would use with all of their new buyers, it's a great handy.
All three of them.
Yeah, that's, I know, and that is true. And we do recognize that issue.
All right, thank you very much. Anybody else would like to testify on Senate Bill 707? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 707. We will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 805. I'm going to call up Scott Beckstead, Paul Shapiro, and Sharon Shields. I'm going to let you know we have 45 minutes to hear this issue. If you have written testimony, please summarize. And we are going to focus on folks who can't come back in case we have to hold this over. Okay, Scott, can you get started, please?
You bet. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. My family and I live in Sutherland, North Douglas County. We are constituents of Senator Pozanski, here today in strong support of Senate Bill 805 as originally drafted, and unfortunately in strong opposition to the -1 through -7 amendments that have been submitted. My purpose here today is to introduce you to the experts that are here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 805. To my left, Paul Shapiro, who is Senior Vice President for the Humane Society of the United States Farm Animal Welfare Programs. To my right, Dr. Sarah Shields, who is an animal behavior and welfare scientist. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go first?
Thanks so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here before you all today. You have written copies of my testimony, so I won't go ahead and read it for you, but just in summary, the Humane Society...
Can you state your name, please?
Thank you. My name is Paul Shapiro with the Humane Society of the United States, which is the largest animal welfare organization in the country. We have about 11 million supporters, about 157,000 of whom reside here in Oregon. And the Humane Society is in favor, as Scott mentioned, of Senate Bill 805 as written, and we're opposed to all of the amendments that have been offered. In short, egg-laying hens here in Oregon right now don't really get that great of a deal. While the state's cruelty code requires that all animals have adequate space for necessary exercise to ensure the health of the animal, the state's cruelty code also exempts all commercially grown poultry, meaning that right now the birds can be confined pretty much as restrictively as the egg industry wants to confine them, and they confine them, as we heard earlier, to the degree where each bird gets only 67 square inches of cage space. Just to put that in perspective, this piece of paper is 93 square inches, so each bird right now, there's about 2.5 million egg-laying hens in Oregon, has this much space on which to live for more than a year before she's slaughtered. It really is difficult to imagine a more miserable existence. The egg industry right now is undergoing a lot of criticism for this extreme confinement of animals because not only is it cruel and inhumane to treat these animals this way, but it's also bad for food safety. That's why later on we'll hear from the Center for Food Safety, who also opposes these amendments but supports the bill as written. And when you look at the egg recall that we had this past summer, more than 500 million eggs recalled, not one of them from cage-free hens, but rather all of them from eggs from caged hens. The trend in the industry right now is moving away from these restrictive battery cages, and we see more and more retailers asking for cage-free eggs, whether it's retailers like Costco and Walmart that have already required that all of their private brand eggs be 100% cage-free, or states like Michigan and California, which have already adopted regulations on this topic that go further than what all of the Dash 1 through 7 amendments do, and in a shorter time frame as well, or whether it's religious leaders around the country or around the world, from the Pope, who has condemned battery cages, to the Dalai Lama, who's condemned battery cages and also called for a shift toward cage-free egg production, which is better for animal welfare and better for food safety. There's also an abundance of science that demonstrates that moving toward cage-free systems is better for both of these reasons. It's not just common sense that confining animals to the point of virtual immobilization is bad for them. There's an abundance of science, and we can hear some of that from Dr. Sarah Shields, and perhaps some of the veterinarians will be testifying in support of 805 as written. But perhaps the most telling study was done by this Blue Ribbon panel, the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. This panel of expert scientists, the Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman, veterinarians, ranchers, and more. And after 2.5 years of studying this very issue, they unanimously, every single one of them, from the Secretary of Agriculture on down, agreed that we need to get rid of battery cages in favor of cage-free systems. The amendments that are being offered to this bill really just give the illusion of reform, when in reality they are essentially codifying the cage confinement of laying hens, and not only codifying that cage confinement, but also saying that they don't even have to give the animals less cramped cages until the year 2026, so far off as to render the amendments virtually meaningless. Even if there were a shorter phase-out date, it would still be less than what other states have done. Just as an example, the Humane Society and the Michigan egg producers came to an agreement in 2009 requiring 144 square inches by the year 2019. Yet here, a state with a much smaller egg industry than Michigan, the egg producers are asking for only 116 square inches by the year 2026. It really just doesn't make any sense. The trend could not be clearer. The egg industry, for the sake of consumers and animals alike, really needs to move toward a cage-free future in the way that Senate Bill 805 does as written. It's a modest bill already as written. 1.5 square feet per bird, which is what the bill would call for, is still a modest amount of space, but it's sufficient for them to be able to engage in normal, natural behaviors that are important for the welfare of these animals and important for food safety as well. With this bill, Oregon has an opportunity to be a real leader when it comes to an issue that so many Oregonians and Americans care about, the humane treatment of animals. It really is just a matter of common sense and common decency to allow these animals to have the modest amount of space that they can just turn around and extend their limbs. So I want to thank you very much for allowing me to testify before you today, and I will turn it over to Dr. Shields.
Okay. Thank you. And Dr. Shields, we have your testimony. I am going to ask you if you could just highlight the key points, because we have quite a bit of written material in front of us. Thank you.
Sure, yes. My name is Dr. Sarah Shields. My degree is in animal behavior, and I have worked in a research setting with all kinds of poultry, including broiler chickens and laying hens. I'm here to express my strong support for SB 805 in its original introduced form. I have thoroughly reviewed the scientific literature in this area. It's part of my job as a consultant and a teacher in animal welfare. And I found that the only system that's being discussed today that can meet the welfare needs of the hens is the cage-free barn or aviary system that gives hens 216 square inches of space, or 1.5 square feet per bird. The reason is cages of all type restrict movement to such a degree that it actually causes physical harm to the hen. So dynamic loading is a process that occurs during normal movements. It causes stresses and strains to bone and muscle every day. And when hens can't engage in that kind of movement, it causes problems for their skeletal development. Hens are selectively bred for egg production, so they're prone to osteoporosis. When you take a hen who's prone to osteoporosis and put her in a cage where she cannot get meaningful amounts of exercise, it causes serious problems with her skeletal system. And you see this when you go to pull the birds out of the cages at the end of the production cycle. They get bone fractures and bone breaks. So it's a very serious problem. The other problem, of course, with cage confinement, and the problem that I think the public largely recognizes, is the severe behavioral restriction that that kind of confinement imposes. So a bird, in a hen in a battery cage, she can only walk a couple of steps. She cannot run, jump, fly, wing flap, scratch, peck and ground. She cannot exercise. She cannot hide. She cannot explore. She cannot perch or nest or dust bathe. And these are all really important behavioral patterns for the hen to express. So the furnished cage was designed an attempt to sort of give the hen some behavioral opportunity in a cage. But unfortunately, it's just impossible to provide for the behavioral needs of a hen in a cage confinement. And that is because hens, like all birds, need space in the vertical dimension, and not just the horizontal dimension. They're birds, and chickens roost in trees at night. It's an anti-predator behavior. And you can actually give a hen a preference test in a behavior experiment in a laboratory and ask her which height of perch she prefers, and they almost always go to the top. They want to be up high off the ground. Now, furnished cages also offer a little sort of a curtained area where the hen is supposed to be able to lay her egg. But you have 60 hens in one of these colony cages, and they all tend to want to lay their eggs in the morning hours. So you get competition for the nest site, you get crowding, and it doesn't fulfill the hen's need for a secluded place in which to lay her egg. The furnished cage was originally designed to give an area of loose litter for dust bathing, but that was impractical on a commercial scale. It's been pulled out of the commercial design and replaced with a little square of astroturf. That does nothing for the hens. It's not appropriate enrichment at all. So I know that you want me to be brief. I won't go into detail. I have a lot of additional science in my testimony. I'm happy to provide any of the references if you need them. I just would like to finish by saying, though, that cage-free housing allows the hens to display a much greater, a much richer behavioral repertoire, and that's why they're needed. Cage-free housing, you're going to hear a lot of talk about manure and disease and biosecurity. Well-run cage-free housing is very clean. The manure is removed on a conveyor belt between the levels of an aviary, or it falls through the floor into a pit below where it's dried. They're very clean when well-managed. There are no additional concerns about predators. Don't be swayed by those arguments. We're talking about indoor, modern housing. So in summary, please vote for SB 805 in its original introduced form. We need to raise the bar for the care and treatment of animals on farms, but there is an inherent limit to how high you can set that bar in a cage. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Questions?
One question. Mm-hmm. How much would it cost a conventional egg grower with 65,000 hens in one building to replace that with the system you're talking about?
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson. You know, there are producers in this room who I think could give you a better idea of the exact cost, but I will say this. You know, animal welfare is a cost of doing business. We can't cut corners by treating the animals poorly. I just don't think it's fair. I don't think it's ethical.
And Vice Chair Olson, I'll just supplement that by saying the United Egg Producers is the main trade association for the battery cage egg industry, and their economic analysis shows that the cost of converting generally is about a 25% cost increase to go from battery cage to cage-free operations. Of course, as Dr. Shields notes, there's hidden costs associated with the extreme confinement of these animals in these cages. Not only the increased cost of animal cruelty, but also the increased cost of food safety risks, because numerous studies have shown that caged operations for laying hens have higher rates of salmonella enteritidis than do cage-free operations. In fact, 15 out of the last 15 studies published on this topic all found higher rates of salmonella in the cage facilities rather than the cage-free facilities. So we do have to weigh what some of these hidden costs are associated with battery cage confinement when we're thinking about raising the bar for animal welfare and what the true cost of the current system actually is.
One follow-up.
Follow-up.
Has Oregon had any of these salmonella outbreaks or issues?
That would be a question better addressed to the producers who would know that. I'm not aware of any in the very recent past. I'd be surprised if there haven't been salmonella concerns in the past, but I can't think of any in the last year or so.
I'll get the egg guys then.
All right.
Any questions down here?
Real quick, your material, Doctor, may cover this, but do you have anything in the literature regarding the quality of the product based on the different types of cages that are used? Second, the disease, I think we just heard, that should be answered. And then I guess I also wonder what happens to the hen after it's past its prime for laying. How are they? What's the next step for them? And if so, is it for human consumption?
Senator Pruszynski, I think that varies depending on the farm. A lot of different producers do different things with their hens. Some are euthanized or killed on the farm, sometimes with carbon dioxide gas. That's one method that's used. Sometimes hens are shipped to slaughter, not commonly. There's just not a market for it right now because broiler chicken meat is so cheap that, you know. I don't know about the egg quality is similar unless, you know, if there are egg quality issues, that's something that needs to be addressed by individual producers. But most, I think, egg producers do a good job of ensuring egg quality in any type of system.
Okay. Yeah. And Senator, I'll just follow up by noting that in all of these commercial egg production systems, whether cage or cage-free, the eggs end up getting washed before they end up going to consumers. So that's why you see really the egg quality can be similar. With salmonella enteritidis, though, the problem is that it can pass from the hen directly into the egg, so no amount of washing can necessarily get that out if there is salmonella in the egg.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm actually going to call up now a panel from the other side. We'll hear from them, and then we'll try as best we can to get the rest of the testimony, but we may have to carry this over. Greg Smith, Mark Oldenkamp, Greg Satrum, is that right? Come up, please. Okay, gentlemen, and whoever wants to go first. Craig, you want to introduce panel?
Senator Dingfelder, thank you so much and committee for allowing us to have this opportunity to testify today on an issue that's of critical importance to all of us. I'm going to turn this over to the panel here just in a second. I just want to lay the groundwork for what we've been involved with over the last couple of months with the President of the Senate and a couple of the other groups here in Oregon that are also here to testify today. We come today opposed to 805 as it's written, but here to tell you that the Dash 6 amendments are the amendments that we've been working on with the Senator, with the President of the Senate, and we are very close to finding, I think, an agreement that we can move forward on that will work both for the industry and for the humane treatment of hens in Oregon. This is a hen care bill. This is not an egg bill, and there is a huge difference there because we care and we want you to understand that we are here to talk about the care of hens. It is very confusing for us, to be quite honest with you, to listen to the previous testimony of the Humane Society of the U.S. and understand that their bill and their initiatives and every agreement that they've made around the United States to date leaves out one in three hens. It's confusing to us, and we honestly don't know why they do that. This bill, the Dash 6 amendments, include liquid eggs, which have not been included in any of the initiatives, are not included in Senate Bill 805 as written, and will include every hen who deserves to be protected. So that is really kind of the starting point for our testimony. We thank you for that, and I'm going to turn it over to Greg Satter.
Can you identify yourself
again?
Oh,
I'm sorry. I'm Craig Smith. I'm the Vice President of the Northwest Food Processors Association and here with the Northwest Poultry Council.
Great. Thank you. Gentlemen, whoever wants to go next.
Yeah, I'll go. Thank you, Senator Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Greg Satrum. I am from Molalla, Oregon. I'm also a co-owner of Willamette Egg Farms. We have egg production facilities in Canby, Oregon, Eagle Point, Oregon, and also up in Moses Lake, Washington. I'm a third-generation egg farmer, and I got to say that when I decided to stay home and work on the farm, I had no idea what I was in for. It's an exciting and terrifying time to be an egg farmer here in Oregon. But our family's been providing locally produced eggs here in the Willamette Valley since 1934. We're proud of what we do. We're proud of how we do it, and we are always looking for ways to do things better. My primary responsibilities on the farm have always been on the hen care, hen management side. So I'm out in the houses on at least on a weekly basis, making management decisions out there. We have conventional, cage-free, and organic production here in Oregon at our farm in Canby. I think it's also important, you know, we're here to discuss hen welfare, but it's important to know that good hen welfare is a critical part of a sustainable egg production system, but there are other concerns that we address as well. Food safety that's been mentioned, that is a huge issue. We have to produce safe quality food, and we're doing a great job of that. Also, caring for our employees. We need to provide them safe environment and living wage jobs, health benefits for their families. We've got to make sure that we're minimizing the impact that our facilities have on the environment. That's very critical. Also, you know, we have to address public attitudes that can shift, and we have to do all this at a price that people are willing to pay for eggs in a very competitive market. So any approach that we take has to really look for balance with all those competing interests. You know, currently we produce purely in response to consumer demand. 95% of our consumers prefer the lower cost conventional egg. Northwest producers are producing an abundant supply of cage-free eggs. They're readily available in all the stores. About 5% of consumers prefer the cage-free egg. We just recently made a large investment in increasing our cage-free production. I'm not anti-cage-free, but I recognize that cage-free has some limitations. No one will argue. We've been doing cage-free for over 10 years. No one will argue that the cage-free system does provide hens with increased access to perform natural behaviors. That's the benefit of the system. Some of the disadvantages to cage-free that don't get a lot of attention are the fact that the hens are actually more prone to injury. Chickens are good at taking off, but they're not so great at landing, and we see a lot of bone fractures in cage-free systems. We also see a lot of hen-to-hen aggression, so that'll come out in the form of feather pecking and even cannibalistic pecking. There's more exposure to pathogens when they're on the floor in the litter, and so we do have some more hen illness issues in those systems. You know, the truth is that their lifespan is actually much shorter in the cage-free system, typically 70 to 75 weeks in comparison with 110 to 115 weeks in a cage system. So as a result, you have fewer eggs per hen over a lifespan. A cage-free mandate would require approximately 40% more hens living and dying to produce the same number of eggs. That is a welfare cost as well. We believe that the American Humane Association standards for enriched colony housing is the future of egg production in Oregon. We also believe that it will be in line with standards that we believe will be developing nationally over the next few years. Colony housing offers hens the behavioral enrichments that the battery cage has been criticized for. It's a much, much larger enclosure. References to sheets of paper don't tell the whole story. The typical enriched colony system is the pen is 4 feet wide and it's about 12 feet long. The average space per hen would be 116 square inches, but as hens move around, they're free to move about that entire space, which gives them a lot of exercise. That is lacking in the conventional cage environment. Also, access to perches, scratching area, nesting area. Those are all behavioral priorities for egg-laying hens. But again, don't get addressed in the conventional cage system. This move is a huge commitment. So to make this commitment to move to the American Humane Standard means for us that we're going to completely change out all of our facilities over the next 15 years. And that's why 15 years is needed, is because we're making a sincere and achievable commitment. You know, some of the agreements that have been made in other states were made under duress, quite frankly, and those producers may never actually intend to comply with those standards because they're hoping that a national standard will take precedent. So to compare this with Michigan is really a bit deceptive. So the housing systems, that we use to care for our hens are a huge investment.
Can you start to wrap up, please?
Yeah, I am wrapping up. Yep, thank you. Farmers simply need to have some assurance of what our standards are going to be in the future as we look to invest in facilities today. And that's really the effort that we're making along with Senator Courtney and his staff, is to find that balanced solution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Dingfelder and Senators. Thank you for this opportunity to provide some additional input. Greg did a... By the way, my name is Mark Oldenkamp. I'm the Vice President of Operations for Valley Fresh Foods. We operate a farm in Woodburn, Oregon called Skyline Farms. We employ 75 people there, and like Greg says, we have good year-round jobs with way more than minimum wage pay scales, health insurance, paid vacations, 401k. So we're trying to provide good, healthy jobs for those that do the work. Greg covered a lot of the background, so I'm going to focus a little bit more on the economics of conversion, just to help save time and try to explain the reasons why that it takes a long time to convert the 2.5 million hens in the state of Oregon to the American Humane Standards. You need to first understand that when we make an investment in the current systems, those systems are designed to last 30 to 35 years. We've got systems at our company built in the last 10 years, and I know others in the state have newer systems than that, and we do need to be able to afford to pay the loans that exist on those current systems as we try to make the investments in the new systems. To give you a little idea on the replacement cost of the different kinds of facilities, if we were talking conventional cages, those have cost $13 to $15 a bird to build. For the 2.5 million birds in the state, that's $35 million. AHA-approved systems, $22 to $26 per bird to build those, about $65 million to convert the 2.5 million hens in the state. If it was entirely cage-free, it's $35 to $40 a bird to build those systems, or about $100 million to completely retrofit to cage-free. If you factor in what we're being told by our customers, the sustainability formula, where hen health and welfare certainly is important, the environment and the ecology and the carbon footprint has to be considered, food safety, public attitudes, human health, and the ethics of the cost of food, all sustainability pieces. The American Humane Association has looked at all of those sustainability pieces and has come to the conclusion that, like Europe, the colony housing systems meet those sustainability pieces better than the other alternatives. So after a lot of investigation, they will tell you that they are now approving American Humane approved systems in rich colony housing that provide those enhancements because they've looked at all of the components and put them in balance. I think Oregon has a real opportunity right now to be a leader in the nation, to set the example of what the future of egg production not only in Oregon could look like, but could look like in the entire United States. And I hope as we work through this, we've still got a few bugs to work out, that we can find a way to come to a conclusion that we can all do the right thing for all of the hens every day, and not only in Oregon, but in the rest of the country.
Great, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator Przanski?
Offline, if you can get back to me with the research and the backing of why 15 years for the transition. What I've heard so far, it sounds like this is the longest length of time for a transition to occur from the states that have been modeled, and I'd like to have more information about why we need 15 years, please.
Sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Before I call up the next panel, I'm just going to make an announcement. Since we're running out of time and some of my members are going to start leaving at 5, We will carry over the work session on Senate Bill 695, so we'll repost that, but just making an announcement that we're carrying that over. And then I'm going to ask folks to come up. We have two more sheets of people. We're going to run out of time, so I need to know who cannot come back on Thursday. So if there's, I think Sharon Harmon and Tim Omlo, is that right? Okay, why don't you come on up? And we'll take folks up until 5, and then we'll carry the hearing over. Yeah, I think we've got... Okay, credit. Okay, and do you want to come up? I don't know your name. I'll say woman in the pink sweater. Come on up. Okay, thank you. Sharon?
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm with the Oregon Humane Society. We are not affiliated with the Humane Society of the United States, American Humane Association, or any other animal welfare group in Oregon. We are the state's largest and oldest animal protection organization. We think Senate Bill 805 doesn't go far enough. I don't understand how we could propose a bill that leaves a third of the birds in the most egregious conditions. And I don't say this because I've looked at pictures in a magazine or surfed the web. I had the good fortune of being invited to Greg Chapman's farm to see the whole plethora of housing conditions. Thanks to Greg and his family for being open and willing to show us the conditions so I could form my own opinion. I also want to thank Senator Courtney and specifically Ryan Mann for fully exploring this issue. This is really tough. What Oregon sets the bar for may be what sets the bar for the rest of the country, but I don't think Senate Bill 805 is the bill in that it only covers the birds that produce eggs in the shell. It doesn't cover the birds that produce a third of the egg products, so-called liquid eggs. Now, I've learned a lot of things in this last couple of months being on the work group. Cage-free doesn't mean no cages. Liquid eggs aren't born liquids. There's a lot of new terms to wrap your head around, but I do know that we need to do something more for chickens. I think we all agree battery cages are a thing of the past and need to go. Where we end up, I think, needs to apply universally to all the birds. I think we need to have uniform standards that address more than just square footage, more than just square inches, rather, so that we look at air quality, we look at environmental enrichment, we look at furnishings, which is another term of art for the egg industry. So we've participated in the work group. We think there's more to talk about. But we think the bill as it's written doesn't go far enough. We're leaning towards the DAS-6 amendments, but we'd still like to continue with the work group to see if we can come to an agreement that works what's right for Oregon farmers and Oregon birds. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon.
Madam Chair and committee, my name is Tim Amlaw. I'm the Vice President of American Humane's Farm Animal Program and the Certified Program. I'm just here to inform you about our standards and practices. We are a 135-year-old organization this year. We've been in the forefront of most legislation and direction in animal protection for that 135 years. Our standards are developed based on a lot of observations. We have probably one of the most rigorous scientific advisory panels, both internationally, and we're currently conducting one of the largest studies of laying hens internationally, both in Europe and the United States, with over 300,000 birds participating in that. And what we look at in that is exactly the things that you're talking about today, is the behavioral components of animals in all living environments. And that study will be done in about a year. And it really, right now, the preliminary study that was announced in Denver this year shows a lot of plasticity and the ability of birds to adapt to environments. We, too, look at the 805-6 amendments in kind of support of those with some working environments for the groups here in Oregon. But we think those actually address all birds, and so we would be in support of that concept. But in addition to that, I would invite you all to go to, if you have your pens, and you can actually pull it up on your website if you can go live, jswest.com. and that is a producer in California that has installed the first enriched colony system, and they have a button there that's called Live Hens, and you can watch the birds 24/7. After about 24 hours, you will get tired of watching the birds and their behavior. But they do migrate, and we know that they migrate quite effectively from the nest area to the opposing scratch area. And what's interesting, late at night, when it's dark, the birds will all perch. And if you watch their performance or their behaviors in those environments, as was previously noted, it really does go a long way to improving the bird's life. With that, I would also invite, on my card that I provided for you, there's a website called thehumanetouch.org. You can certainly go on there and take a look at our science advisory panel, as well as our standards and practices, and the standards specifically that the Ohio Oregon producers will be participating under. I also have served over the last year on the Ohio subcommittees for the new Welfare Standards Board that was enacted there a year ago. And we've worked very hard on some of these same issues, which are really, really tough ones for all parts of this. But we came to good resolution, and I think you have that opportunity here with your groups in Oregon. So I would encourage you to support that and support your groups, and again, go on jswest.com because that's where you'll see the new enriched colony cages in actual operation. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Good afternoon. My name is Ginger Rapport, and for the last 16 years, I've had the great pleasure of having a job that I am deeply honored to do, and that has been to manage Oregon's largest farmers market, the Beaverton Farmers Market. When I first started in 1996, there were 26 markets in this state. That number has grown every year. Today, there are more than 120. Every Saturday, 20,000 people at Beaverton alone make the commitment to purchase local foods and to support those farms and businesses that produce healthier, higher quality, and more humanely raised products. In my time as market manager, it has been gratifying to watch our customers become more informed about their food choices and more demanding about the circumstances under which their food was raised. Writer and Eat Local food champion Michael Pollan implores his readers to vote with your fork, and I'm here to tell you that they do. Each week, the market sells out of eggs that customers know are fresh from the farm and come from hens that were not confined to a life in cages. These higher expectations by our customers led us this year to refine our rules for egg vendors to include not only cage-free, but also that those hens have time on pasture. While I know that this exceeds what we are asking for now, it is important for you to understand that consumers, your constituents, in ever-increasing numbers, wish to eat food that does not contribute to the misery of other living creatures. They demonstrate that time and time again as they buy naturally raised eggs, meats, and dairy products in our farmers' markets. The minute amount of space given to laying hens whose lives are spent in battery cages is at its best inhumane and at its worst barbaric. Please consider supporting Senate Bill 805 in its original form. You must make this happen on behalf of all egg-laying hens and on behalf of all people who support eating with a conscience.
Thank you.
I have one question, if you don't mind.
Yep, Senator Olson.
And I'm not chicken to ask you this question.
Sure.
How much do you... Well, you got one, so I get one. Yeah. How much do your eggs cost in the farmer's market?
About $5 to $6 a dozen, and I can't get enough of them in the market. They sell out every week.
They vary, because in Eugene they're cheaper.
Beaverton, because it's the biggest market, prices tend to be a little higher because vendors know that they can ask more.
Senator Hass is a district, so we don't know if, like...
Kelly has some nice coats. We only have shirts.
I just, as an aside, there's no rhyme or reason, but Beaverton has the largest farmer's market in the state by far.
Yeah. That's why I can't come back on Thursday. I'm getting ready to open a market.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much. And I also have Sarah, is it Sarah Hedge? Sarah, that's from over 100 miles away, and we have about 8 more minutes. Anybody else who can't come back on Thursday to testify? So why don't you all come up? Okay, Sarah, you want to get started?
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you guys for the opportunity to testify here. My name is Dr. Zara Hedge. I received my doctorate in veterinary medicine from Western University of Health Sciences in 2009. I've been working in Oregon as a veterinarian at a Humane Society for the last 2 years, and I'm here today to represent the Humane Society Veterinary Medical Association and express my strong support for SB 805 in its original form. As a shelter veterinarian here in Oregon, I deal with large populations of animals, and it's an important consideration when dealing with any population of animal in a confined situation is housing size and density. A crucial aspect of an animal's well-being is ensuring their behavioral needs are met, and this is as true for farm animals such as hens as it is for dogs and cats. And as people have talked before me have discussed, hens in battery cages are not able to express a wide variety of natural behaviors. This can lead to frustration and act as a chronic stressor. Chronic stress in a lot of species of animals can have profound impacts on health. It can negatively impact the immune system, making you more immunosuppressed and more susceptible to disease. I feel that behavioral needs of animals are often overlooked, especially when it comes to farm animals. And I think we forget how large a role behavior plays in overall health. I believe that ensuring animals are able to express natural behaviors is just as important as ensuring that they receive proper vaccinations, proper medical care, proper nutrition. SB 805 in its original form will help to greatly improve the overall welfare of hens. And so I ask that you guys support SB 805 in its original form. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Jenny Keating, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'll be summarizing the main points from a prepared statement on behalf of Andrew Kimbrell, Executive Director of the Center for Food Safety. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. The Center for Food Safety supports SB 805 as originally introduced. Amending this bill to allow for slightly less cramped cages would do little at all to address key food safety concerns. The cage confinement of hens on industrialized farms is a potent food safety threat. An abundance of scientific research demonstrates that keeping laying hens in cages increases the risk of salmonella when compared to keeping the birds in a cage-free hen house. This is the reason so many consumer protection and food safety advocacy groups endorse a ban on cage confinement of hens and support moving toward a cage-free future. For the sake of food safety, we urge you to support SB 805 as originally introduced and oppose any amendments to weaken the bill to allow slightly less cramped cages, let alone with a phase-in date as long away as 2026. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Johnson. I've been asked to speak on behalf of Kendra Kimbrowskis, the president of the Oregon Friends of Family Farmers based in Malala. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here to testify in person. She's very sorry. She had an animal emergency on her farm that prevented her from being here today. You've received her written testimony, and I'm just going to read a few key portions of that testimony and also note that Oregon Friends of Family Farmers was able to attend one work group in December regarding the formulation of the proposed amendments and was not invited to any further meetings to provide input on SB 805. As the state's largest advocacy organization for family-scaled agriculture, I'd like to express my support for SB 805 as introduced and our opposition to the proposed amendments, which, in our view, only create an illusion that the egg industry is taking meaningful steps to improve the lives of their laying hens. Not only is factory farming bad for the animals, it jeopardizes food safety and allows corporate agribusiness to unfairly compete with family farmers who put animal welfare rather than profits as a central component to their agriculture enterprises. The transition toward cage-free conditions by 2019, as is outlined in SB 805 without amendments, is more than a generous amount of time for the egg industry to implement the required changes to their systems. To suggest that they need more time than that to give their animals slightly less crowded conditions is nonsensical, bad public policy, and should be opposed. The fact is, the amendments proposed to SB 805 are simply a means to deceive the public into believing that the commercial egg industry is taking meaningful steps to improve the lives of the hens, when the reality is that it's business as usual. Please support SB 805 as introduced. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have one for the panel.
Yep.
If we were to do SB 805 originally, the original issue, how do you think that $100 million that would cost to switch this production system over, how do you think that would affect the egg producers in our state?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, unfortunately, I could not speak to that. That would be a question for the egg producers.
All right. Thank you very much for coming here today and sharing your testimony. And is that Matt sitting behind that? You want to come up? I know that you can come back. Is there anybody else who can't come back on Thursday? We have four other people signed up. Everyone else is okay? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Matthew Dominguez. With me today, I have Jill Buckley's written testimony. She's the Senior Director of Legislative Affairs and Mediation Training for the ASBCA. She regrets she could not be here today in person. Obviously, in the interest of time, I will keep this very brief. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, ASBCA, its 21,000 members and donors in the state of Oregon support SB 805 as it is currently written and strongly oppose all the amendments. The ASBCA believes by codifying the confinement of laying hens in inhumane cages ignores very serious animal welfare and food safety concerns. Therefore, the ASBCA respectfully urges you not to amend SB 805. Thank you for the opportunity to testify with you today.
Okay. Question?
Same question to you. How do you think this will affect our egg producers if they have to come up with $100 million?
I really can't speak to that, and that's a question for the egg layers.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So with that, we will. I'm going to close the public hearing, but I'm again going to make the announcement that we're going to carry this over till Thursday, and that's Senate Bill 805, correct?
Yep.
We've got about four people signed up, and just to confirm, I know two people are in the. Yes. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 805, which will be carried over. And just a reminder, we will be carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 695 to Thursday as well. And with that, we will close the Senate Committee on Environment